friend of mine that is a theologian, and by theologian I mean this guy's got his PhD in theology. He knows his stuff. And as I was talking with him one day, he came in and said, I said, how was your weekend? And he said, I got asked the truly impossible question this week. He said questions like, can God make a rock so big that he can't pick it up? That's lightweight stuff. He said, this was truly the impossible question. He said, it was spring cleaning day outside in our flower beds and bushes and all that stuff. He said, I was already outside with the kids. My wife walked outside in a pair of shorts. And she posed to me the truly impossible question, which was this. Have I always looked this bad in these shorts? Or have I gained weight this year? And he said, what I recognize is there's no right answer. So when posed with a difficult question, he said, honey, you're beautiful. And he just decided to leave it at that. There are all those questions in life where we say, Lord, what do we do with it? That's the impossible question. How about a difficult question? Lord, show me something in my life where I've grown content and shake up my faith a little bit and teach me to trust you more. If you've ever prayed that, you know that's a dangerous prayer. I know friends that have prayed it, and it's led them into confronting years of difficult relationships. It's led them some into unexpected pregnancies. It's led some into adoptions, some into career changes, some into moves. But we're going to talk about another difficult question in Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is one that shows the depth of David's relationship with the Lord, and you see the Lord's involvement in David's life. This is a psalm that gets quoted a lot, and a lot of times it gets quoted out of context. So hopefully today we'll put it in context and we'll have a better understanding. The psalm actually breaks into two parts, and you're going to notice the shift. There's this one part of the psalm that is David is talking and crying out to God, and he's talking about how great and intimate their relationship is, and then it's like, there is a change in this last part of the psalm. We're going to get to talk about all that today. And through it all, hopefully, what we're going to understand is the courage that it takes to ask a question that David asks at the end of this, that I really believe we will only ask if we truly understand God's love for us. Otherwise, it's too scary. Psalm 139, if you've got a copy of Scripture, I'd invite you to open it up. If you do not have a copy of Scripture, we have some copies available in the back of the room. Psalm 139, look with me down, starting in verse 1. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up, you discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all together. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, and I cannot attain it. That's the first part of it. If you've been around church, you know that word omniscience. It means that God is all-knowing, and that's what David's describing. Because the Lord knows his people. Look at those words. You know, you discern, you're acquainted with. Look how strong those words are. That David is aware that there's nothing about him that the Lord doesn't know. Think with me about that for a second. There is nothing that he doesn't know. His every thought, his every motive, his every behavior, the Lord knows it all. He says, you know when I sit and when I rise, you know when I go out, you know when I come home at night and lay down, you know when I'm speaking, you know what I'm going to say before I say it. Now think with me for a minute what that might feel like. To be exposed at that level that you can't play the game anymore with somebody. You know, when you walk up to people and you talk with people and you're thinking one thing, but what comes out of your mouth sounds a lot prettier than what you're thinking. David is aware that it doesn't matter what's coming out of his mouth because the Lord is acquainted with and knows everything going on in here. And so before that word's even in his tongue, the Lord already knows David's going to say this. That's incredibly vulnerable. What a God. I've been married for 21 years. Ellen and I know each other really well. We can read each other's minds as well as any couple can that have been married for 21 years. And you know what? There's times where we still blow it. So I end up with statements like this. Ellen, what are you trying to say? Just tell it to me. Because what I know is this. If I can misinterpret, I will misinterpret. There was a time years ago where we were newlyweds and I was learning that thing. Husbands, if you haven't learned it yet, now might be the time. When your wife comes to you with a problem, she's not asking for you to solve it. Yeah, no way. They want you to listen, which didn't make sense to me. Because if you're coming to talk with me about it, obviously you want some of this wisdom I have, right? No, you just want me to listen, okay. And so we were working really hard on it. We'd been married about 6 months. And so she communicated that. I didn't get it, but I was trying. So we had this day where something happened to her at work, and she came home, and she's like, I want to tell you about my day. And she was upset. And I'm thinking, okay, Lance, don't solve it. Just sit there and just listen. So I'm sitting there, and she's talking, and I'm listening. And by that, I really mean I'm sitting there not talking. Because inside my brain, I'm not listening. I'm patting myself on the back for not saying anything. I'm like, oh, Lance, you're doing so good. You just keep being silent. And I was doing great at that. I'm pretty simple. Give me some rules, I'll follow them. And we got to the end of that, and I'm so busy patting myself on the back, and Ellen looked at me and she goes, I can't believe you agree with her. And something went off in my head like I missed something. Because I was so busy patting myself on the back. And she said, I can't believe you agree with her. I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And she said, you didn't say anything. You told me the other day you want me to just remain silent. She said, well, you need to know the difference when I need you to affirm me. And I looked at her and said, I don't get it. And so I'm happy to tell you, and if you're married, guys, write this one down. When she said, hey, can I share something with you? My next question is this. Yes, but what are you looking for? Do you need a solution? Do you need affirmation? Or do you just need to be listened to? And she tells me. And then I play that role. I gotta tell you, we know each other really well. And I still can't read that woman's mind. And she's an incredible gift. And she can't read my mind. Imagine with me that there's a God in heaven that knows your thoughts before they occur to you. Because that's who he is. You know everything. You discern my thoughts from afar. He knows what you're going to think next week about something you're unaware of. That's our God. And David's saying, I'm amazed that you know that much about me. Now let's be honest. How many of you think you are lovable when somebody knows that much about what happens in your brain? Because how many of us have had that thought where we said, if I look this way, then everybody will accept me. But if somebody really knew what went on between my ears, I would no longer be accepted. Because we've all been there. And at some level, we think, I'm just going to play the part. I'm going to carry my big Bible. I'll be involved in Bible studies. I'll learn to say, oh, bless you, every time they sneeze. And I'm going to really look the part. Think with me about a God in heaven that says, I don't care if you look the part. I know what's going on between your brain, and I still love you. That's what happened to the woman at the well. That's an all-knowing God. And I want you to know that there's this God in heaven that even though he is all-knowing, he still moves towards you and he still moves toward me with an overwhelming heart of compassion. That's who he is. And he loves you and he loves me. So look back down. So he says, God, you know when I come and when I go, when I stand, when I sit, you know what I'm thinking before I think about it. You know what I'm going to say before I speak it. That is incredible. I can't even ascertain that. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. My brain goes dead in that moment because I can't comprehend that you know everything about me and you still love me. So look at the next part. Verse 7. Where shall I go from your spirit? Because if everything about you is known, wouldn't you want to go hide? Because he might come after you. And he might say, hey, remember that? You know, when you did that, you were thinking this. Everybody else thought you looked great. I knew what was really going on. You and I might be prone to run and hide. I don't like it when somebody knows everything about me. It feels vulnerable. It feels exposed. And so David says, where can I go to get away from you? Where shall I flee from your presence? And he gives us some more of these. If I come, if I go, if I stand, if I sit, if he keeps giving you all these things. Here he goes again. If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed into Sheol, you are there. Okay? From top to bottom, I can't get away from you. There is no latitude, latitude, where I can get away from you. And then look at this next one. This next part, he says, if I take the wings of the morning, the sun rises in the east, and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, looking west. So it doesn't matter if I'm down in Sheol or in the heavens, if I'm from the east to the west, it doesn't matter. I can't hide from you, God. Even if your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. Aren't those such touching terms? Think with me, when you were a child, when you had those moments and you got scared, the first thing you did was you put your hand up for your parent or some guardian or some person who was a caregiver for you to grab your hand. Even the first part, he talks about that your hand is upon me. He keeps giving us these really caring, nurturing adjectives to describe God's love towards him. It doesn't matter. Your hand's on me. Those moments when I'm walking somewhere with my kids when they're young and they sense fear. And what do? They get real close to you. And you put your arm around them and you pull them close. And that pull close means I'm with you. You don't need to be scared right now. I've got you. That's what those terms mean. And it's exactly what he's saying. You know everything about me. That's really scary. But your hand is upon me. Okay, I'm going to learn to live in comfort with that. And they said, I can't even escape you. I'm so vulnerable to you, God, because you know everything about me. You're up there, you're down there, you're over there, you're over there. That's really scary, but you're holding my hand. So there's a God that I can't get anything past, and there's a God that I cannot avoid, and his response is, I've got your hand. It's going to be okay. Because he's not using it to hurt you. He's not using it against you. He's not trying to blackmail you. His heart for you is good. So is it possible that if he knows everything about you and his heart is for good, that maybe, just maybe, that he's going to use that knowledge about you that he has that you don't even have yet to speak into the depths of your soul to provide healing and love at a level that you never even knew was possible? I think that's what David is trying to communicate. It's interesting because if you think back to mythology, think back to the system of the mythological gods. They all were gods in some realm. There was Aphrodite, who was the goddess of love and beauty. Apollo, the god of music and art. Ares, the god of war. He had Zeus, who was the father of the gods, for sure, but he was the god of the skies. David's writing at a time where they couldn't even comprehend a God that was this big. David's saying, you know, you got your whole system of gods where everybody's over something. My God is over it all. That's different. And it's overwhelming. I've shared the story before about what it was like when my wife was over in Russia and I couldn't get a hold of her. And part of God's working on me was, Lance, you think you can protect her? You can't protect her when she's in Russia. You can't protect her when she's in the United States. You can't protect her when she is in Dallas on the North Toll Road. And as I shared with you last week, when she was in an accident, I was incapable of protecting her on Highway 59. So I laughingly said, my phrase last week was hashtag angels and airbags. Because there's a God that's everywhere. And he's got our back and he's holding our hands and he's got his hands on us. I don't have to be afraid. His knowledge knows no limits. His presence knows no limits. That's a big God. Committed to you with his hand upon you, pulling you close. And it's out of that that he comes to this. Look down with me at verse 13. And this is the part that a lot of people know about this psalm. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows that very well. My frame was not hidden for you when I was made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance in your book before were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet none of them were. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I were to count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I'm still with you. See, this passage has some emphatic words to it. And it's real important as we understand this. And I highlighted the words in yellow for you. Look at the words. Look at who the active agent in this is. You have gifts. You have skills. You have abilities. And for you to acknowledge that is not bragging. It's the recognition that there is a God who formed you, who knitted you, who he worked in your life. His eye saw your unformed body. It's his book. I want you to recognize the emphatic use of pronouns here. God is the active agent in putting all of this together. Because when we look at the next part, look at the words that are passive. I was fearfully and wonderfully made. It's not about me. It's about him. My frame was not hidden from him. I was being made. See, these are all passive verbs. My book, those days were written. They were formed for me. Understand that there's this God that is all-knowing. There's this God that is everywhere you can go, and he has put an incredible calling and gifting upon you. He's doing this work in you, and you have the privilege of going along for the ride because it's his work, and he's the one active doing it. Now, what we know is this, and in our day and age, with all the Planned Parenthood videos that have been coming out, and they are horrific. If you've seen them, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And looking up this stuff, and we think about that, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. At 42 days, a baby's skeleton is complete and has reflexes. That's at 6 weeks. At 43 days, the next day, you can start measuring brain waves in the child. By 49 days, at 7 weeks, you have complete fingers, toes, and ears. By 56 days, the eighth week, all organs are functioning. Stomach, liver, kidney, brain, all systems are intact. By 20 weeks, this child has hair, vocal cords that are working, and can suck his or her thumb. See, that's our God, and he's knitting you together in the womb. That's not an accident. How do we know? Because he's omniscient, because he's omnipresent, and that omnipresence, sure, it goes from the heavens down to Sheol and from the east to the west. You know where else it goes? It goes all the way to the womb as God is knitting that child together. David, I've got a plan and a calling for your life. It's overwhelming. And people want to figure out, what's God's plan for me? Well, he's doing that. That's why I'm not for identity formation. God's already formed the identity. Our quest is identity discovery. Who did God wire you to be? And how is he at work? And what did he put there? You know what? I was never going to be an NBA basketball player. He didn't give me what I needed to do that. But what he called me to do, he has equipped me to do. And the same thing is true for you and me. That's why when Rick Warren came out with the book, The Purpose-Driven Life, it made such headway in the church because it was finally as though somebody said, you matter and God wants to use you. If you did it, you know that he gave you this acronym, SHAPE, your spiritual gift. What do you have a heart for? What are the abilities you bring to the table? What's your personality, the blend of tasks and people? How do you handle that? And then E is your experiences. What has God put in your life that he can use for his glory in the future? And the church just went nuts about it Because you all of a sudden had people saying, you mean God can use me? And you wanted to say, yeah, read Psalm 139. God can use you. Matter of fact, if we take it to Paul in Ephesians 4, we're going to talk about this in the next couple of weeks. If you go into Ephesians 4, I would tell you that anytime a church body isn't healthy, if we really believe that he gave us everything we need, then why we're not healthy is because there are people that don't understand that God is doing something in them and through them. I think that's what Ephesians 4 is saying. I think that's what David's saying here. So, everything's great, right? Psalm 139. I love this God that knows everything about me. It could be scary, but his hands are upon me. I love this God that's everywhere. That can be scary, but he's holding my hand because I can't get away from him. That feels vulnerable. Matter of fact, the fact that God's everywhere extends all the way to the womb. And then we get to this. And this is where the radical shift takes place. Look with me at verse 19. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with a complete hatred, and I count them as my enemies. Anybody notice the shift? You're great. You know everything. You're everywhere. You got a plan for babies from the womb. I hate those people. See the shift? Certainly you caught it, right? When we come to Psalms like this, and you'll see certain Psalms throughout this, and the word, if you've got a study Bible, is called an imprecatory Psalm. You might see that word. Imprecatory means to call down a curse. And there are several Psalms that have them. We see them in the Psalms of David, which is one of these. This is one of those, excuse me. We see it in the Psalms of Asaph. We also see that with Jeremiah and Nehemiah, where we see God literally calling down a curse. And it presents something interesting for us, because when we come to the Psalms, they're very emotional, they're very real, which is why it's such a book that ties to our hearts, because we can read this. Because if we're real honest, on our ugly days, remember our thoughts, not the ones that everybody can see, our thoughts, we have these things where we're like, God, go get them. Just go get them. Because I'm tired of dealing with them. That's your version of an imprecatory psalm. So we see this. So the question is, how do we handle this as a New Testament church? When we come and we look up and we say things like, turn the other cheek. And we read things about loving your enemies. How in the world does this work? And this is the difficult question. And we're going to come back to it. Look back down with me at verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. By the way, that try me and know my thoughts was a legal term. He's like, God, put me in the court of law and put a judge and a jury on there, and I want you to open up my brain, and I want you to show everything that's in there. Why? Because he's omniscient. He's capable of doing that. That was the first part of the psalm. See, when all we do is extract verse 13 through 18 from this psalm, and people do that all the time, and those are great words, but it's part of the whole. Because when we get to the end of this, he's saying, God, I want you to search me. I want you to put me on trial for the way that I think. Well, who's capable of being on trial for their thoughts? Well, you and I are when there's a God in heaven who's omniscient. See, he's capable of doing this. What does he want to go on trial for? He wants to go on trial for verse 19. That's that imprecatory psalm. This is the dilemma that New Testament churches have to walk within. We have to walk within the love your enemy. We have to walk within turn the other cheek. And the part that churches are always uncomfortable with is how do we fight for justice and God's righteousness in the world? Look at David's words of what he's calling down judgment on. Slay the wicked, those men of blood, they want to destroy people. They speak against you, God, with malicious intent. What's his anger? His anger is, God, there's all these people that want to destroy and they want to tear you down. And his words are, God, I want you to fight for righteousness. This isn't a personal hatred that David has for these people. This is a righteous indignation of saying, God, these people are against you. And because you and I are so closely linked, I see this the same way you see it. God, where are you? Show up for justice today. I mean, look at the rest of the words. Do I not hate those who hate you? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? If they hate you, I count them as my own enemies. Because David said, we're right there, God. We're team. And if they hate you, they hate me. And if they're for you, then I'm for them. Because we're like this. So what's he telling them to search him for? If I were to ask you, when I was reading verse 19 through 22, if a name came into your head and you were thinking, yeah, I feel that way about this person, here's the difficult question. Before an omniscient God who knows what's here, would you say that your disdain for that person is because they are attacking the God of righteousness? Or is it a personal vindication of you feeling attacked by them? Oh, see how dangerous that just got? Because there's only one who actually can put you on trial for the way you think. Not what you say, not that you're like, I'm sorry, and you're like, I know to say I'm sorry, so I'll say I'm sorry. And I know that when they say I'm sorry, you're supposed to say, I forgive you. And you can say, well, I'm going to say it, but I'm not going to mean it. I'm going to hold on to that. And you're like, I forgive you. Do you really? Oh, yeah, I forgive you. There's a God in heaven that knows that you're thinking, he's calling you on your bluff. He's looking up, he's saying, God, I want these people to pay for their unrighteousness. And then he takes a step back and he asks the very difficult question, doesn't he? But God, how I feel right now, I'm offering that up to you. You dissect me on this. You put me on trial and you share with me whether or not I'm righteous in that anger or if I'm unrighteous in that anger. And if there's unrighteousness in that anger, I know you're going to deal with me. One, because you're omniscient. Two, because you're omnipresent. I can't get away from you. Three, because you formed me in my mother's womb and you've got something better for me than for me to walk around angry and pitied and all those things are going to happen to me because I won't let go of something. God, you put me on trial and deal with my heart right now. See how dangerous that just got? It's real easy for us to joke about questions that are difficult. Maybe the most difficult question you could ask is say, God, put me on trial and expose what I think about to either being just and righteous or being unjust and unrighteous. And then deal with me accordingly. Because I don't want anything. Think with me. If your thoughts are unrighteous, then that has created a separation from you and God. So David loves God enough to say, we're the same team, and whatever is going to get in the way of that, put me on trial, expose it to me so I can deal with it, and we can get back to this. How many relationships have we lost over the years, not because of this, but because there was something else in between, and we let that run amok? David's heart for Christ is so strong that he says, show me exactly what's going on in my brain, because I'm tempted to manufacture stuff. I'm tempted to rationalize stuff. I'm tempted to justify stuff. And matter of fact, I'll even go so far as to say, I will even put it in the God language to say, I'm mad about their unrighteousness. And God, the omniscient, is able to look at you and say, this isn't about me at all. This is about you, and it's about that person, and you won't fight through it. See how dangerous this got? Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts and see if there's any grievous way in me. When you expose it and when you show that, remember how scary it can be? What were the terminologies? Your hand upon me, holding my hand. God, if you see anything grievous in me, you better grab my hand because I'm not going to want to walk into that. Grab my hand, pull me close, and teach me to walk through it so I can get back to this, because whatever this is blocking us, and it's a scary place to be. Here's what I want you to know. Omniscient God knows everything. Omnipresent God, you can't escape. He's in the heavens, he's down in Sheol, he's from the east, he's to the west. You cannot escape him. But he's willing to hold your hand. He's willing to put his arm around you. Matter of fact, he crafted you in the womb. And I come to this tape, to this book, and I've shared about this before, and it's funny because somebody brought a quote up to me about this today. Ragamuffin Gospel. I think Manning captures something in our brokenness that so many people miss. If Jesus appeared at your dining room table tonight with the knowledge of everything you are and are not, with a total comprehension of your life story and every skeleton hidden in your closet, if he laid out the real state of your present discipleship with the hidden agenda, the mixed motives and the dark desires buried in your psyche, you would feel his acceptance and forgiveness. That is a true statement. That's what the woman at the well felt. It's what David felt, because he's willing to say, Jesus, put me on trial and show me. Because what's not at stake is my acceptance. What is not at stake is whether or not you will forgive me. What's at stake is, do I know you well enough to walk with you and be led in the way everlasting? I think Manning captures that in our brokenness. One last thought. That famous paragraph from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where they're talking to the beavers. Remember that scene? And we have this, Aslan is a lion, the lion, the great lion. Ooh, said Susan, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. That you will, dearie, and no mistake, said Mrs. Beaver. If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly. Then he isn't safe, said Lucy, the littlest girl. Safe, said Mrs. Beaver. Don't you hear what Miss Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. I want you to know that when you and I pray Psalm 139, there's a God who knows everything. You can't escape him. He's everywhere. He was even in the womb knitting you together. And when we go before him, he knows exactly what's going on in our brain. Is he safe? No, because he might call you out of that foolish sin of yours. And he might lead you into something better in the way everlasting, which is what you were created for. May not be safe, but it is good. And as he walks us, he holds our hand and he puts his arm around you. Join me in prayer. Father, the idea of an all-knowing, omnipresent God can be really scary and intimidating. Especially one that's knit us together. You know us far better than we know ourselves. And so when we come to you, you know the sincerity of our heart. You know the motivation, the right and the wrong motivation. You know where our flesh gets in the way. You know all of those things. But Father, I pray that we'd be a church of men and women who are bold enough on the basis of the shed blood of your Son, Jesus Christ. On the basis that you long to hold our hand and put your arm around us. That we might be bold enough to say, Lord, search me, know me. Separate me from the foolishness and lead me in the way everlasting. Do a work in us that cares more about being close with you than maintaining or protecting our false facades of life. It is in your Son's name we pray. Amen. As you go this week, walk with him. And when it gets scary, ask him to put his arm around you. Ask him to hold your hand and ask him to lead you in the way everlasting. You are dismissed.